Welcome to Your Career Cure podcast, where amazing professionals and entrepreneurs share their inspirational stories so you can get a dose of a happy career, happy life. And now, your host, Gail Tolstoy Miller.
Welcome, folks. Welcome to another episode of Your Career Cure. I am so excited because today we have the impressive networking expert, Kelly Hoey. Kelly Hoey is the author of Build Your Dream Network and hosts a podcast by the same name. A frequent speaker and source for networking insights, she's been lauded from Forbes as one of five women changing the world of VC entrepreneurship to Fast Company, one of the 25 smartest women on Twitter. Wow. To Business Insider, one of the 100 most influential tech women on Twitter, and Inc., one of 10 most well-connected people in New York City startup scene. Empowering a billion women by 2020 included her on the list of the 100 most influential global leaders empowering women worldwide. Not bad from a former corporate lawyer. She's a limited partner in two emerging tech funds, sits on the board of the Women's Media Group, and can frequently be found on Twitter, which I will provide all the information in the liner notes. So, Kelly, welcome. Welcome. What an impressive background.
Well, why, thank you. And I'm kind of grinning away. Maybe listeners can hear that in my voice because some of those accolades amuse me. It's, you know, things you didn't set out to do with your law degree, you know, be recognized as a smart person on Twitter. You know, I'm sure my parents are terrifically proud of that distinction. And I guess I'm kind of grinning away because I feel like I'm just getting started in my career. Like that kind of feels like the amuse-bouche to my, you know, my career meal at this point and that I have so much more to give and contribute. So that's what I feel when I hear my bio.
So it's interesting. So you were practicing attorney? Mm-hmm. Why don't we go back? So you went to law school. What type of law did you practice?
So I'll just say this, in terms of someone graduating, back in the day, I didn't feel I had a choice. There wasn't a choice of doing a gap year. There wasn't a choice of, it was like, you will go and get an undergraduate degree and you will get a graduate degree. Okay. And in terms of the graduate degree, I sort of sat there and went, no to medical. Yeah, not for an MBA. So default, got a law degree. Very practical matter at the time. This was back in the early 90s. I was living in Canada. I'm Canadian. And salaries in Toronto were more than double those of Vancouver, where I had gone to law school and grew up on the West Coast. And the cost of living was the same. So by absolute default, financial, I ended up in Toronto. And then at one point got staffed on a matter that was, you know, banking and insolvency. And that's what I did a lot of before moving to New York in 1998.
Oh, okay.
And then did corporate. And then from the legal career, moved into law firm management. But we can dive into that because there's lots of lessons there.
So, yeah, I'm sure. Actually, I was this close to going to law school. Got in, ready to go, same thing, you know, undergrad. And my family, they were all attorneys. I was going to go for it. And I'm like, there's no way I can go through with this. And I ended up in the music industry. So, go from
there. That's amazing. I mean, the sad thing for me is, when I think about it, is that a legal education is an extraordinary education in terms of how you problem solve and the critical thinking and the advocacy. It's a shame it's so expensive because just as purely as an education, I think it's a really worthwhile degree. And it's just so out of reach unless, you know, you come from means or you want to drag around student debt forever, or you take a job at, you know, a big firm that pays you extraordinary amounts of money. It's just really, it's unfortunate.
Yeah. And I think in California, correct me if I'm wrong, you could become an attorney without going to law school. I think you can intern for a law firm and that equates for a couple of years and that may equate to actually going to law school?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, so in Canada, we had to do that kind of, I'm going to say, like an internship, but mm-hmm. you're an articling student. So before you get admitted to the bar, you had to do this sort of additional training year. And that's sort of the British system as well. And it's, I wish more jurisdictions had that because it really did help you hone your skills. But yeah, so I went to law school by default and my law degree, I will not tell anyone what it cost me because it was so cheap.
Well, yeah. Well, now, of course, I'm sure.
Even at the time it was cheap, I have to tell you.
Oh, really?
It was really cheap.
Wow. So it was worth it for you. I mean, I mean, I agree with you. A law degree, what you learn probably is valuable in business, right? I mean, that's why a lot of people, they get their law degree. They don't really practice law, but it's useful for them in running an organization or working for a company.
Right. Or I have friends who went into journalism who had law degrees. In terms of, like I said, again, how you analyze, text and language and how you, source out the facts and all of those things, the line of questioning you think. So I think it's, it's kind of a shame in terms of some of the things we think about careers and how people pursue and what they choose to pursue. I think some of what we need earlier in our career is just the opportunity to think.
Absolutely. So what was your experience as an attorney? Were you happy doing it? Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, I actually did. I was not one of those people who's like, yahoo, I always think it's such a funny profession. You congratulate people for not practicing law. And I'm like, all right, that's kind of congratulating people for crapping out on a career or failing at a career. I really enjoyed the practice of law until a point that I was like, okay, this is going to continue on this same pattern. I don't know if I want to go for partnership. Where do I want to take this? Because practicing per se wasn't like causing me to have great career aggravation, but it was almost like having sand in your shoe. There was just like something was off. So that was back in sort of 2001, kind of in there. And that's where I sort of sat down and said, okay, what is it? Is it the office and the firm I'm working at? So I did go and interview with other firms to say, all right, is it this? Which part of the four corners of this is wrong? I went and interviewed in-house and I'm like, no. So then I sat down kind of, back of the envelope and said, what do I enjoy? What gets me excited when I come to work and what stuff, kind of sucks, to put it bluntly. And from that, I started exploring my career options because I realized I really did like being in that sort of high energy, environment. I liked the deadlines. I liked the urgency. I liked having to make things happen. I loved mentoring other people. I liked people who were really driven in terms of what it was that they were doing. And on the basis of that, I decided I wanted to go on to the management side of the legal profession, and in particular, lawyer training and professional development. So helping other people, with their careers. And that may sound like, oh my God, Kelly, that's about the most boring, like one side of the, the ledger to the other side of the ledger. But, maybe it goes back to and thinking about people listening to this and how they look at their own careers. I was very much kind of shuddered in those horses in Central Park, where I live in New York City now, where I had a very limited view of what I could do with my career and what was acceptable to do with my career and where possibly my skills could have a home. And this is, where networks come in handy because they can help you see bigger visions or a bit more possibilities. So I decided to go on to the management side. Sort of second or third career lesson on that one was those were the jobs at the time were only filled by word of mouth. You had to know someone to tell you there was an opening. They had to recommend you. And I didn't have that network. So I needed to spend probably better part of a year and a half, you know, building and cultivating that profession, very specific professional network to land that next job.
How did you do that? What was your...
Yeah, the how do you build it before you need it?
Yeah, it sounds, you know, great, you did it, but like it's not easy because networking is very difficult for most people.
Yeah. And we can get into, you know, how I think about networking and think about it differently, but let's dive into this building of a new network.
Yeah.
So I needed to sort of discover what it was I wanted to do before I narrowed in on the professional development role. And so it was like literally making a list of like questions and then thinking about, all right, who is the best person to ask? And thinking about people I already knew who had may have made that transition. So because I was making this, in hindsight, a very small step in a career change, you know, lawyer to manager of lawyers, I could think about whether there were people I had worked with at one of my previous firms who had made a similar change. So I could go and talk to them first saying, how did you do this? And then from there, I could get kind of like the next person to talk to and then the next person to talk to. And each of those conversations, I would not do the networking thing of, hey, who else do you think I should talk about? At the beginning, I was really like, what were their recommendations for me to position myself before having those further conversations? So what were the skill sets that perhaps were lacking on my resume? Where could there be questions in an interview where someone would say, well, that's nice, Kelly, but you haven't done this. So I could, you know, backfill by, you know, taking courses. What were the types of organizations or professional groups that these people belong to? And could I be part of those conversations? What were they reading? You know, what conferences were they attending? Like, I just kind of literally would find out initially all that information. And then I sort of lived the role before I had it. So that if I did meet these people, I could be talking to them as a peer, as opposed to, I really want this job. You know, can you help me get one?
Right.
It was because knowing, and I remember sort of knowing how it worked, really worked in my favor. And I remember meeting someone who was quite senior, and she looked at me and she said, well, I'd like to tell you who to meet, but it seems you've met everybody who you need to meet who could get you one of these jobs. So just keep me posted on who you're talking to and what you're reading and what you're doing, and I'll let you know if I hear something. It was frustrating because there was times that I interviewed for roles, didn't get them, and then was told later that people said, yeah, we just knew in 6 months you'd be bored with the job because you were too advanced for it, but you weren't qualified for something more senior. And I'm like, oh, you know, how many of us have had that?
Yeah, it's like you're in between. You're right. There's, you're not quite up there and you're too good for it down here. And there's no place in the middle.
Right. Well, I was like, but I haven't done this job. Why didn't you give me a chance for 6, 9, 12 months? Wouldn't that have been better than, you know, just outright rejecting? Like,
right.
Anyway, but the person who did that, she ended up becoming a great mentor and friend for many years in the profession. And I spent a lot of time, you know, kind of reading things, emailing people to say, hey, thought of you in our conversation and you read this, and just kept doing those things until someone called and said, need you to come in. Someone just quit. I've got an opening.
That's awesome.
And yeah, it was, like I said, it was frustrating that I wish it had gone faster. You know, 18 months is kind of a long time to keep chugging along when you know what you know, have such clarity on what you want to do and the frustrations with that. But the good news was when I did land the job, I had the outside professional network of peers and a strong network that those kind of critical first 90 days in a new job, I had people to call and say, have you ever faced this? Have you had this problem? What are you guys doing about this? Oh, and I had credibility in the firm because I moved to a new firm. I had credibility in that firm because I could talk with authority on what their competitors were doing.
Right.
So that was critical.
So it sounds to me that you were very, very prepared for the new role. You weren't just waiting to make it happen. You were preparing for it and continuing to network as you were preparing. So you were taking courses, correct? You were doing a lot of reading. That is great advice, I think, to someone, is start acting like you're in the role and prepare for it. So when you do meet the key people, you're there already.
You're already there. And I mean, other things I did was discovered there was a committee for a relevant, you know, bar association. So anyone could go and look and say, all right, where do these people in this role I want to be in, where do they aggregate? You know, is there a mandatory kind of licensing or something like that? Or is there something that they voluntarily they join? And so there was a committee that put on, you know, programming for lawyers, you know, kind of for the profession, mirroring what people would do in their own firms. And so I got my butt on that committee. No better way to network with everyone you want to meet than calling them up and asking them to be on a panel. I got to tell you, people take your call when you do that.
That is so true. That's so true. It being the one of the most important people in the room and having your eyes, all eyes on you, that's priceless.
Mm-hmm. And that committee, there was, you know, probably 15, 20 people on it. So they were hearing about opportunities. They were saying, hey, this is what's going on in my firm. So really having a pulse on the industry by being on that committee. And so when I think about networking, it's not just working a room, it's volunteering, it's mentoring, it's, you know, attending, it's participating, finding ways to make yourself visible, that in that visibility, you can create opportunities for yourself.
But what happens if you're a person that really doesn't like that?
Like what?
I mean, like you don't like, yeah, like you're an introvert, it's too much stimulation, it's just way too much, and it's overwhelming, and you just don't like doing those things. It doesn't come naturally.
Okay, so you are just tapping on my favorite topic when it comes to networking. So first of all, I think people need to ditch what they think networking is. So if you think networking is, you know, like the schmoozy meeting strangers activity, like that's what it is. Like, I'm making a career change, I got to go out and do this. If you think that is all that networking is, just write that on a little piece of paper. And after you listen to this podcast, or you'd have to pause it now and walk to the bathroom and flush that piece of paper down the toilet. Like, just ditch it. Like, get rid of that thinking. For me, networking is every single human interaction. So it could be, I don't know, suggesting that this is a fabulous podcast to listen to and you can't go a week without listening to Gail, so you tell your friends to listen to it. That to me is networking. Right? Posting on Facebook that this is a great podcast and others should listen to it. That to me is networking. Wishing someone a happy birthday is networking. How volunteering, mentoring, how you, your email signature line, all of these things create touch points with other people that can further, you know, develop, grow relationships. So think about everything you do as part of your networking arsenal. On introverts, I'm going to give you a case study from my book, Build Your Dream Network. It's one of my favorites. And Joe, who works at GoDaddy, is an introvert. And not, you know, on the mild end of the spectrum of introverted. He is quite introverted. Joe is one of the best network builders I have ever met. And part of that is his intentionality. He focuses on what he can control. And he can control his relationships with other people, like those immediately around him. He's an incredible mentor. He's an incredible manager. He's very thoughtful in his interactions with his colleagues. He is also, you know, intentional. And as he notes, he has control over his choice to invest in his own professional development. So if that means taking his own time to go and meet with someone to get information, if that means using his own time and his own dime to attend a conference, then he goes and does that. And he is very considerate in terms of building that trust. In terms of stepping into big, uncomfortable situations, that's where he grounds the reason for why he's doing it. Like, why am I going to a big old conference with like 50,000 people in Vegas? I mean, talk about hell for an introvert. he's like, this is why I'm doing this. This is the industry conference for everybody in my profession. This is the role I am going after, and I need to understand what the trends and the stats and the dynamics are. I need to start building a reputation here, because if I hope to land that promotion, I need to be on top of my game. And that's kind of a pep talk that he gives himself, because it's not like he's all of a sudden like, oh, gee, I could be the life of the party. But grounding those into those kind of uncertainty, that uncertain, confusing, anxious-causing situations, grounding it in, oh, this is why I'm doing this, can be a bit of a salve if you are, you know, more introverted. But let's all face it, we've all had, you know, networking events where we've been happy to have our face in our phone because we have no idea why we're there and we're really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So understanding why you've made that choice and how it matters to you is really important.
Right. So it's just knowing your why and then making the best of it, of the situation. It's kind of like a means to an end, right?
Yeah, but sort of setting it up. Like, so what I often say to people when someone says to you, oh, you should attend. Gail says, oh, you have to go to this. My reaction is don't hit RSVP and rush off and slide your credit card and sign up. Stop, big breath, pause, and look at Gail and say, tell me more. Tell me more about this organization. Tell me more about this event. How have you benefited? Like, ask those questions so that you can decide whether or not it aligns with what it is you're trying to do or who you're seeking to engage with or the time that you have to invest in the activity. And that should make some of your choices of how and where you choose to spend your time engaging with others far more, I want to say, pleasant and productive.
Right. But let's say you're really stuck. Like, I'm an introvert and I'm off the charts introvert. So when I go to events, and I've gotten better at it because I think it takes practice, just like anything else, like public speaking, going to networking, and networking does take practice. But someone like me goes into a big room to an event that you just mentioned. What's the first step, right? So we know what the why is. We need to do this. We need to build our business. We need, you know, sales. We need to network to get our next job. But then you freeze up and then you end up standing in a corner. You end up going to the bathroom. You end up staying near the food. You end up talking to one person and it's just, you can't break out to the next step of just really meeting and having meaningful conversations instead of feeling forced and uncomfortable and your pitch sucks. Not even so much pitch, just like you can't even, it just feels awkward to have start small talk. What do you do?
So let's break it down.
I know there's a lot there. There's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot. No, but let's break it down. Like, so you, even with your why, right? Break it down even further. So let's use Joe's example again. I'm attending a big conference in Vegas because it's the industry, all the industry leaders here. The first time he went, it was like, I need to understand what they're talking about. I need to understand and pay attention to what's going on. So that might be kind of going to one of those events like Inspector Gadget, just to pay attention to the dynamic. So do you need to leave with 50 business cards? No. You need to leave with information and understanding and plan your next step rather than thinking a single event is one and done.
Right.
In terms of meeting people. So really break it down. Why are you there? Are you there to hear the speaker? Are you, you know, there because you want to understand the organization and how they work because you've heard it's a really important one? Well, if it was that case, I would say, talk to the organizers when you walk in the room. Hi, this is my first time. I've heard a lot about this organization. Who do you think I should meet? Is there a member who's you can introduce me to who's been involved for a longer time? I'd really like to talk to them about this organization. You know exactly why you're there, you know, to do that. I mean, when I got involved in the startup community, I would go to I looked like the psycho networker. and I'm not an introvert. I'm an ambivert. So people think I'm an extrovert, and I'm not. I'm an ambivert. So so I, you know, can get totally weirded out at networking events as well. And when I was getting involved in the startup community, I would look like the psycho networker, like party queen of New York, going to 3, 4, 5 events a night. But sometimes I would walk in and I would do that, Gail. I would stand in the back and just watch, because I needed to figure out the dynamic and whether it was worth my time to invest time in the future in that particular meetup, you know, startup group, whatever. And so I needed to check people off the, you know, check groups and people off the list so I could decide where it was worth, you know, kind of diving into deeper to build relationships. So this is where I'm like, really unpack why you're there and why you've chosen. So say you're going to an event because it is to hear the speaker. Well, get your butt up to the front row or the second row and sit your butt down to hear the speaker and take notes. You don't need to leave. I do not adhere to the advice that you need to leave with so many business cards. Someone sits down next to you at that event. God bless when we can sit down at events again. Anyway, I just had to throw that in there. You know, someone sits down to be able to say, you know, if they say, hi, how are you? Why are you here tonight? I'm here because I've really wanted to hear the speaker. Have you heard them speak before? There's an icebreaker, because you know you can ground the start of your conversations on the reason why you chose to attend.
Right. That makes sense. And I think a lot of it too is what you do after. So even if you do speak to one person and you're there to gather information, then what do you do after when you go back to your office, right? That's kind of like where the magic works too. Also, depending upon what your purpose is.
I mean, that's where the magic is.
Yeah.
People ask me what the biggest networking mistake is, and I always say it's the failure to follow up or follow through. So, you know, not emailing back or doing a request to connect on LinkedIn that says, it was lovely to meet you last night. Thanks very much for giving me XYZ information. Or, hey, it was great to meet you, and I'm going to, you know, look into that subcommittee you mentioned. And then when you looked into that subcommittee, email them back and say, wow, you're absolutely right. I've, you know, submitted. They asked for a recommendation from someone who's already a member, you know, for me to join. You know, would you mind vouching for me? Like, that's those additional, you know, communications. That's what takes sort of a, hey, it was nice to meet this person. They were kind of interesting. That's what starts to pull people into your network. And that's where you can create mentors and advisors and someone who may remain a casual acquaintance, but it's more than just sort of a passing, well, that was a nice way to spend some time.
Right.
Whatever kind of situation.
Makes sense. So I kind of want to go back to your career, because this is fascinating how, like, I want to finish that. I know we were talking about networking. So lawyer, management of attorneys, and then what happens after that? Because you mentioned VCs and entrepreneur and you won all these awards. Oh, yeah. How do we go from here to here?
So, yeah, how did the interesting stuff really happen? So
I want to know. And the audience wants to know. This is fascinating.
So everything in my life is all based on networks and relationships. So there was lessons early in my career as a lawyer in terms of the importance of developing, you know, kind of those long-term investments in client relationships. And then to make the career change, it was like, oh, right, the lesson of you need to build networks before you need them. And having too narrow and specific a network is going to limit your career possibilities. So, you know, there was that lesson. When I was in law firm management, the lesson was, you know what, your internal network, your colleagues, not just the immediate ones, the ones who were across departments, across offices, because it was a global firm I was at doing professional development. Those are critical for helping you get your job done and as well as opening doors. So I moved from professional development into marketing at that firm. And you know, my peer network of colleagues was critical to that.
Did you want that, or did that just happen organically?
I hit the glass. Did I want the peer relationships or the marketing?
Like, yeah. How did you get into the marketing? Did you want that? Were you seeking that? Or was it just an opportunity that kind of just fell on your lap?
I hit the glass ceiling in the department I was at. And my boss and I both recognized that. And he's like, we could either find another role for you here, or we find you a role in another firm. And I'm like, okay, let's see what's out there. And sort of shooting on about in sort of three directions on things. And the chief marketing officer of the firm was like, hold on. What do you mean? She might go to another firm. That's not happening. I'm going to create a role for her here in marketing. So that's where, like you said, I didn't apply for it. There wasn't a role at the time. It was something that they were thinking about in marketing. So I moved into an alumni role to head up the firm's alumni program. But having those relationships and people being able to vouch for me, but also that strong reputation of my work product just because of what other people were saying. So, so that internal network is really critical for your career. But it was when I was in the marketing role. So anyone who's in a, you know, corporation right now could probably going to relate to what I'm going to say. So I was in this marketing role, and I was told that creating this alumni program was one of the most important projects that the firm was doing. And then they gave me no staff and no budget to make it happen.
Here you go. Here's your gift. But it's empty. There's
Here, Kelly, here's a stick of gum and a paperclip. Make it happen.
Welcome to corporate America.
And I think of it as like where my entrepreneurial mindset started, because you can't just say, well, I can't do this. You figure out a way to make it happen.
Right.
So I sat back and I thought about it, and I thought, okay, I do not have budget. I don't have staff. But I have people who want to be connected with this firm, and I need to find a way to harness it that does not rely on budget and a big staff. And I looked around and thought, is there any examples out there of voluntary communities? Because that's what an alumni group is. Any examples of those that are really propelled by the activity of the membership, as opposed to being a top-down, where's a bottom-up? Because I need that bottom-up example, because our alumni program's got me, and you know I'm good, but I don't need to be working like around the clock trying to make this happen. So I looked around, and I found an organization that at the time, it was a global business group for women, and at the time, the organization was known as 85 Broads. Huh. And it's now known as Elevate. And 85 Broads had originally started off as an informal alumni group of women who worked at Goldman Sachs. And the name 85 Broads was tongue in cheek on Goldman Sachs's old headquarters on Wall Street, which was at 85 Broad Street. Yep. So I was like, okay, let's go check this out. People have told me about it before. And here's like the lesson. And I'm spending a lot of time on this because this is the lesson that, in terms of where everything else kind of stumbles from. So I became a member of 85 Broads, and I didn't just become a member. I threw myself into that organization. And the big reason why at the time, and the only reason why I was doing it, is like, I needed to understand, like I needed to lift up the hood, right? I needed to just see what they were doing, because I needed to know if there was lessons I could apply in the job that I was doing. Like I loved my job. I had a great job in spite of being given a paperclip and a stick of gum to make an alumni program. I really loved the role and the creativity and this kind of uncharted water I was treading in. And my involvement in 85 Broads was predicated on that. I wasn't seeking anything else. I was just like, what's going on here? And I got to figure it out. So they had a website that you had a profile and you could blog on. I did. They asked for submissions for things, I raised my hand. They asked for volunteers, I raised my hand. They asked people, like I did everything so I could understand what the management of this organization was doing, as well as what the membership, what was driving them. And then kind of sitting back and taking those lessons and applying them to the program I was developing. But in the course of doing that, and it was not a very long time, it was probably within 6 or 8 months of joining, the founder of 85 Broads called me, a woman by the name of Janet Hansen. And she said, I want to know who you are and what you do. Hmm. Okay, she'd been a trader on Wall Street, so it was a little harsher and scarier than that. And I told her, I'm like, here's who I am. This is what I'm doing. Because she said, because you're asking interesting questions. You're asking questions that the other members don't ask. And so I talked to her about what I was doing and who I was and my sort of networking story. And at the end of an hour-long phone call, she offered me a job that had previously never existed.
That's crazy.
I'm sure it didn't exist at the beginning of the phone call either, knowing Janet. And she asked me if I wanted to become the president, the global president of AVD5 Broads, and help her and bring my skill set to her. So, you know, the big lesson on that is like, you can get, you know, you can be a member of an organization or you can really get involved as a way to, you know, further your own business. As a way to further the career you're doing now, or as a way to raise profile, right? Like, don't just join and expect, you know, magical networking fairy dust to land upon you. You've got to be active and attract it to you. And I kind of paused about, God, should I take this career leap? Because I was leaving a paycheck, you know, and benefits for a role that was going to pay me only equity. So it was a it was a big change. And one of the reasons I made the change was someone kind of knocked me on the side of the head and said, what's the worst that can happen? You have a network, you have a reputation that is really strong in the legal industry and in professional development and marketing. You just come back in a year to another job in this industry. And knowing that that was my safety net enabled me to take this big uncertain step and to see my skill set in a whole new light and a whole new possibility. So from there, that's everything else just kind of stumbled from there because of sort of repeating those lessons that, and I would say, and those networking habits that had really started, you know, from the day I graduated from, you know, from law school in 1991.
I just think you're a great example of someone who creates their own opportunity. And 80% of the jobs are not advertised. It's like you're an accidental job seeker almost, right?
Yeah, it's like how can you do things? I mean, and on from a business development side, I mean, I'll give you another example of someone from my book who was creating a new line of business. And this, again, this is stuff that other people can do. This is not like, oh, she was just lucky. It's like,
No, you create
your own luck. You put your own career in front of serendipity. And Jennifer showed up at an event in an industry where she was building a new line of business and she knew no one. She showed up and it was, you know, some lunchtime event, and she noticed that the organizers were a bit disorganized. And the name tag table was a holy hot mess. And she said, can I help you? I'm new. Here's who I am. Do you need a hand? And they were like, yes. Why don't you take the name tag table? That was like being handed like a tray of gold.
Yeah.
And as she said, she walked in knowing no one and she left with 80 business cards and 80 business leads. So, you know, you can look at some of these things thinking, oh my God, I'm too good for that. You could look at that saying, oh, well, I'm not going to meet anyone if I'm handing out name tags. Oh, sure as hell you are meeting everybody. You make everyone take the name tag from you. I'm the one who has to do the agenda. Oh, that's a good excuse to talk to everybody on the board and get to know them. So start looking at some of those tasks as networking. You know, I say to people, audit your involvement with organizations if you think you're not getting something out of it. You know, is it them or is it you? Is there a way of shifting your involvement and your engagement to create more opportunities for yourself?
That's great advice. So what happened after that? So you worked there, and what happened after that experience?
Yeah, did that for a year. Then I sort of decided that, you know, kind of doing my own thing was, you know, was this was a great way to, you know, to kick me out of, you know, the comfort zone of, you know, getting a W-2. As I was sort of pondering what next, I got a phone call from a couple of women who said, we have an idea and we keep telling people what we're doing. And we keep describing the skill set we're looking for in a third co-founder. And your name keeps coming up. And that's, you know, maybe one of those other networking lessons. I mean, it's one thing to say to someone, I'm a self-starter, you know, we can all put that, you know, I take initiative, I'm this, I'm that. We can all put that in a cover letter or LinkedIn profile. But actually doing so that other people say you have that skill set is so much more powerful. And so my name kept coming up and I said, I'll hear you out. And that's how I became the co-founder of a startup accelerator, which was, I want to say, one of the smartest and stupidest things I've ever done in my life.
I think if I'd known more,
I would have been nah. But if I'd known more and said nah, I wouldn't have had some of the extraordinary experiences I had. So I'm very glad I did it. I'm very glad it's not what I'm doing today. So I did that. That's how I got involved in angel investing and became LP in a couple of funds. It again expanded and it sort of globally expounded my, you know, where my network went, gave me lots of opportunities in terms of speaking and creating visibility. And all of this just sort of unbeknownst to me until I started to put together a book proposal. All this was laying the foundation of what I would need to have in place to be an attractive prospect for a literary agent and a publisher, not just having a good idea, but having this networking, marketing, PR, you know, kind of machine that I had developed personally and not knowing why I was doing it other than it was the right thing to be doing for each of the roles I was in. So yeah, it was after 85 Broads and kind of stepping out. But again, people knowing what I was capable of and then coming to me with opportunities.
Right. So what made you want to write a book? What was the driving factor behind that?
Well, I think this is, you know, another networking lesson for people. It's like, listen to your network. What do they ask you for? And a very common thread through all of these, you know, various career twists and turns were networks and relationships and guiding other people on doing that as well. And so ultimately, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back and said, you know, I'm going to write a damn book, which is not a career. It was never a career bucket list for me. I will say that. I had a couple of authors reach out to me for my networking insights. And I kind of went, hold on. If I'm the networker's networker, maybe I should write the book.
Right.
So that's, hold on. If someone's going to run off with my ideas, maybe I got to own my own ideas.
Right, so. Exactly. Because someone else will write your book, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like, hell no, that's mine. I'm going to take it. So that's why that happened. And as soon as I had the idea to write the book, it was like obsession with doing it. So,
how long did it take you?
I had, let me think, 4.5 months to deliver a manuscript once the book sold.
Wow.
The legal, you know what? The corporate legal career, like training.
Oh, yeah.
Like the muscle memory came, you know, just zooming right on back. Because I was like, okay, client gave me a deadline. Don't know how I'm going to make it, but we're going to meet the deadline. We'll close on that date.
That's crazy. So you probably lived and breathed your book for 4 months.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what are you doing now? What's your focus now?
Well, I mean, thankfully, you know, people still are confused and anxious on networking. Thankfully, when people are confused and anxious on careers, because that's not a fun place to be, as I know personally. And so my advice seems to be as relevant as ever before. How people are navigating this crazy world of networking online, lots of people seeking guidance on that. And in the course of all of this, the seed has been planted for the next book. So I'm busy researching and doing some test groups and a very sort of ongoing survey, because the next book is focused on the network structure that women need to be successful.
That's amazing. And when is that supposed to be released? Do you have a release date?
Nope, don't have a release date yet, but I'd like to I want to say the next year, because it's given the effects of the past year on women's careers, both involuntary and voluntarily, the information for me is and the guidance, not just to, hey, here's a bunch of research and stats throwing at you, but here's how you can apply it to move your career, your business, your ambitions ahead, is critical to get it out.
So you just mentioned COVID. How do you think COVID has changed the landscape?
Well, structurally in our networks, there's things that it has done. All of us have experienced network shrinkage. And the network shrinkage most of us have suffered from is those kind of accidental acquaintance type relationships. And I think we realize how much we miss those and how much they bring meaning to our lives. So that's the kind of the member of a group or a meetup or association that you saw every third, Wednesday of a month, and you don't see that person anymore. Like the barista at Starbucks used to have a banter with, like those relationships actually do a lot for our mental health and well-being and life satisfaction. And so that network has suffered shrinkage. That network is also very critical because it's the kind of network that tosses up opportunities. But other networks are closer friends. Those have, in some ways, been enhanced over this time. Because we have those, particularly as women, we have those deep relationships. And so we've been able to have that emotional support. Going forward, I know I've sort of mentioned how nice it would be to sit in a chair next to someone at an event. I think we just need to be amphibious in our networking. That is, we need to be comfortable networking online and off, and treating digital spaces as we would physical spaces in terms of engaging and connecting with other people. Because going forward, we're going to need to be able to take offline relationships and further and deepen them online, and vice versa.
Right. And I think Zoom is good, and it's also bad in a sense, but I think it's good when we do go back to in-person that you could go to Zoom and still cultivate the relationship on Zoom and have that face-to-face. So I think it has brought some more awareness to the face-to-face online aspect.
Yes, but I'm like, but how you tweet, how you comment on someone's post on LinkedIn, how you engage on Instagram, all of that, like bring who you are so that if I did get on a Zoom with you or we did meet in person, I wasn't thinking, God, who's this person? I enjoyed that conversation on Twitter, but that's not the jerk who's standing in front of me, right? The funniest comment I ever got from someone was like, you're taller than you appear on Twitter. And I'm like, okay, that's like the weirdest like comment ever. But the source of it was, I'm the same person.
Right.
And how you engage with me on Twitter or Instagram or LinkedIn, I don't want to meet you in person and have a jarring, kind of tripping over, the doorstep or something, thinking, whoa, what happened there? One of my great mentors is someone I've had a, ongoing conversation with, text, DMs, a few phone calls, one meeting in person over, God, a decade now. And it's all happened on Twitter, but, I could text him right now and say, hey, ears burning, talked about you again on another podcast. But it's the same person that we've had a banter on Twitter, that when we get off of that, it was really easy to accelerate the mentoring relationship and the friendship when we had that one opportunity because of all those touch points on those other platforms. So I guess it's my only other kind of, and it's a drum I've been beating for a long time, Gail, is like treat digital as real. It is not secondary inadequate networking. It is not an excuse for a one-way marketing funnel as a human being. Treat other people as human beings and the benefits will be just exponential.
So you think it's important. So let's say I want to meet, I'm going to throw a name out there, Mark Cuban.
Okay.
should I follow him and just comment on a lot of the posts that he has to build rapport?
Yeah. Like, see how he engages. So the example that I was just talking about, so it was the author, Tom Peters, who wrote In Search of Excellence, best-selling business book for 40 years. So sort of like a Mark Cuban in the sense, like, if you had the chance to run in, like, where would we run into these people?
Right.
Like, you'd have to spend way too much money on a, you know, basketball game, you know, and hopefully, you know, get invited. And then what are you going to do? Like, gush like some sort of freak, sycophant, like, hello, you're the greatest. I've always wanted to meet you, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'd feel like such a jerk. What's that going to get you? Security hauling you out of there.
Yeah, you're banned, okay? You're banned from the stadium.
Your face with a big, face with a big, you know, extra. So I started following Tom because I was interested in what he had to talk about, corporate governance issues. And so, you know, I don't think of a like or a retweet any different than if we were at a cocktail party and you said something interesting and I nodded my head, right? Or if you said something interesting, I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. Like, how's that any different than making a comment or, gee, that's interesting, but have you thought about this? It's like cocktail party banter. So that's what my mind goes to when I step on Twitter. Let's have a cocktail party banter. Who do I want to talk to? And at some point, Tom started following me. And that kind of led to this banter. When he saw I was writing a book, he was like, congratulations. And then he DM'd me to say, I ordered your book. And I'm like, whoa, like, thank you. We have the same publisher. I could actually send you the book maybe, or maybe they would send you the book. And that's what started the mentoring relationship at that point. I would kind of keep him up to date on things because this door had opened. But, you know, if we look at digital as marketing, we're just going to hit kind of a sales like closed door in our face because people think that's weird. If we approach it saying this is building a relationship, this is building rapport, to use the word use, which is a perfect word. This is, I'm going to invest the time and the patience to meet someone. And in paying attention to other people, there may be an opportunity to speed up a conversation because you see something they need and you can direct them to an answer. But otherwise, you know what? See what happens.
Yeah. No, it's great advice. Absolutely. So you've definitely had a very colorful, interesting career, without a doubt. I love it. It's great. And I think it's great for the audience to see that you could start at your career in one way and end up doing something completely different and evolves naturally sometimes. And you may not be seeking it, but it just kind of, I'm not saying it falls in your lap because you're making it happen. All the things that you did, you made it happen, but it fell in your lap because you did those things, right?
Right.
In a sense. But let me ask you this. What was your worst career moment? Because everyone has them. And I think it's important for the audience to maybe learn something from your worst career moment.
Well, the full story would involve you and I having to sit down with a large bottle of wine for me to walk through it. And you would be drinking most of the wine because you'd be like, that didn't happen, Kelly. No, that did not happen, Kelly. But the punchline of it was getting a horrifically bad performance review very early in my legal career.
Wow.
I think some of it was valid and some of it was malice, truly. And having to kind of suck that up and say, right, I'm going to take this. And then kind of going, okay.
Why was there malice? Was it a man or a woman? Not that I'm just curious.
A man. Oh, and then that's the one where when you and I can get together, I'll buy the wine,
because
you promised to drink.
Back then, being a female attorney, because I know, I remember when my dad, he had his own practice. And I mean, this is way back. And I would hear how he would talk about the female attorneys. They didn't respect them as much as the male. And that was just a sign of the times back then. That's how female attorneys were treated.
Right. Well, this is a whole story of someone who had been a great champion and mentor, and it spiraled into.
Oh, yeah.
Good and dark. Good and dark. Full of all sorts of twists and turns. And
We might have to do another podcast for this one.
We'll be recording it live and everyone will be hearing the clinking of the glasses.
Hey, we'll have a glass of wine. We'll do it over wine.
You got it. You got it. And That was really a horribly low moment to have kind of crashed from being viewed as someone with high potential at this firm to someone who was basically, you're being put on notice. You get your act together in this period of time or you're out. And being so ferociously demoralized and having to put on that brave face and come to work and sort of saying, hey, what are you going to do about this? And ultimately what I did about it was I had a very strong reputation as well outside the firm. And that led to an opportunity for me to go to a different firm. And, you know, kind of, I would say I did get to recreate myself, but I also didn't internalize the malice of this performance, the malice part of that performance review as being truth. I could see that what it was, I could take the parts of the performance review and say, you know what, this is accurate. There are some things I need to improve. But this whole part of this performance review that was highly personal in its criticism, ultimately, you know, the word of one person that I was a poor performer, being able to ground that in that person's issues and that person's negativity and that person's ill will, and not using it as of saying, well, I'm a shitty lawyer and I should pack up my, you know, legal profession and go work at the Gap, right, or whatever.
So do you think the person actually believed it, or was there something behind that sabotage?
That's where the wine comes in.
Oh, no. See, now you got to, can you give us like a Reader's Digest version of this?
Sexual harassment.
Okay.
So you did extraordinary scale.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
So he probably made advances to you. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did you ever report him?
All right. You want the real punchline?
Yeah.
You know, when your harasser becomes engaged to your mother, what do you do?
Holy shit.
This is when someone needs to have a video of this.
I'm sorry. What the F? Okay.
Exactly.
Now my Jersey, New York is coming out. What? Oh my God.
Exactly.
Okay. Now my mind is blown. You can't make this shit up. It's like a soap opera.
No, you can't. You can't. You can't.
Are they still married?
No, they never got married. They never got married. It was almost like a tactic.
So
that was almost like where I sat, knowing that that was never going to happen. Like the engagement was never going to happen. So it turned a family relationship against me, leveraging that dynamic. Yeah, there was weirdness up the wazoo.
But I want to understand this. Was he sexually harassing you while he was dating your mother?
So before, and then when he started dating my mother, and by the way, dating my mother and getting engaged to my mother, that happened probably over a 3-week period.
Did you introduce them? How did they
meet? My mother came out. Yeah, my mother had come out to Toronto to see me because I was in the midst of a marriage breakdown and I needed support. Oh. And she came out and she had heard me talk about this great mentor of mine, because this is the weird thing. This guy who was this harasser was my greatest mentor. And I learned so many phenomenal lessons. I would, you know, maybe that's the title of a future book. Great lessons I learned from really shitty people, because he was the worst person. You talk about Jekyll and Hyde, but he was an extraordinary mentor, extraordinary, and gave me unbelievable career opportunities until he didn't. And so my mother had come out to visit me, and the next thing I know, she was like moving in with him, and yeah.
Oh yeah. My gosh. So that is very complicated because here he is giving you a poor performance review and he's about to marry your mother. I mean, did she get involved in this? Were you, must have been angry. You're probably like, what the heck are you doing with this guy?
Oh, so of course she got involved with it. And she thought, you know, she was just like obsessed with being wined and dined with this, you know, this guy. I mean, I knew it was never going to go anywhere, but I had to keep my mouth shut because he was the person I reported to. He was the big biller at the law firm I was at. He was the one that everyone was going to listen to as to whether or not I was a good attorney or not. And I knew that this thing with my mother was never going to go anywhere. And in the meantime, he's like, you know, telling me how fabulously, you know, he is, and I could be getting what he was giving my mother. Ooh, yeah.
Ooh, oh, this is so cringeworthy. I can't.
Oh, I know.
I mean, if you're listening to this, you could watch my facial expressions on YouTube, okay? Because we're going to have... I'm like almost speechless, which I'm usually not. This is crazy ass shit. Excuse my friend. I don't even.
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. Oh, it's crazy.
I can't imagine what you felt at this point. I mean, that is just, it's such drama.
And I'm so removed from it now that it's, you know, because this was, this would be like 93, 94, 95.
Yeah, that's a long time.
When this happened, that I moved firms and, you know, then I moved to New York. But there was a time when I lived in New York and I had mailed, because lawyers used to have dictaphones, you know, little teeny tapes, right? Like, so this was before you did, you know, recorded things in the cloud. You had them on little, like, not eight track tapes, but, you know, little tapes. I used to record this guy's voicemails and all the messages he left me on my dictaphone on these little tapes. And then I mailed the tapes to a friend here in New York. And that friend finally, I don't forget when it was, might've been a decade later, was like, yo, you still need me to hold these things? And he handed me all the tapes. And that was like a physical blow when I realized how much for a period of time I had been so terrorized.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
What advice would you give someone that has someone that is really out to get them for whatever reason, that's harassing them, sexually harassing? I mean, you've been through it. What's your advice? What do you think someone should do? I mean, it's a different time now, but.
It is absolutely a different time. I mean, I needed to stay quiet because the legal profession in Toronto was so small. And if I wanted to go and get another job, I mean, in hindsight, this guy ended up sabotaging his own career. And
I was going to ask you what happened to him.
Sabotaged his own career and, you know, spiraled into alcoholism and you know, prematurely, you know, sort of had an early death. He was a brilliant lawyer. It was really sad. But I remember
karma's
other,
a bitch.
Yeah, exactly.
Karma's
yeah, exactly.
A bitch, isn't it? Huh?
Exactly. These other lawyers who I worked with, you know, very senior in the profession, and when all the things about this guy came out, one of them, you know, kind of standing next to me and looking straight ahead, not at me. We're both like looking straight ahead. He was like, did that happen to you? And I'm like, mm-hmm. And he just said, I'm so very sorry. Mm. And I knew that at that time and in that profession, silence was the best route to go because this man had such an aura and still had such power. And there's people who so wanted to help him and had wanted him to get over all of his own demons. Today, you know, I guess some of it depends on your situation of whether you need to, you know, be quiet like I did, but I am in awe of the women who speak up and more in awe of the women who speak up in the moment. For me, I can reflect on these things later because, you know, there was a time and a place that it happened and a time and a place for my behavior and a time and a place that I needed to take the actions I did because I was so scared and just like, okay, I have to take the silence route. But I'm in awe of the women who speak up loudly and boldly mm-hmm. now. In the moment it happens, and I applaud their bravery and I applaud their choice to do that. But at the end of the day, anyone has to do what's right for them and their livelihood, their sanity, their security, their safety.
Right. Makes sense. All right. Well, Kelly, you've been amazing. Fascinating. An amazing guest. I could spend hours just on that. I mean, that could have been a podcast. We could have spent an hour on just that scenario. But we are at the final round, and I ask all my guests this question. I call it the $50 million career cure round. Now,
okay,
you're not going to get $50 million. I just have to say that, a disclaimer, but it's just for fun. So really quickly, first question, what kind of cure would you give someone to cure their either career or entrepreneurial mistakes, if you can give one cure?
It's only a mistake if you keep doing it.
Okay.
Right? Like, it's only a mistake if you keep trying the same solution and it keeps failing. That's a mistake if you tried something and it didn't work out. Okay, that solution didn't work out. Next, try the next one.
Okay. Next question. What would be your cure to improve corporate America?
Listen to women.
Good advice. Third question. What would be your cure to get someone from stuck to unstuck?
Oh. Ask your network, what do you think I do well?
That's good.
See and listen to what they say. Because that may help you get unstuck.
Awesome. Good. Well, thank you for that great advice. Now, is there anything you want to promote at this point? Tell our audience.
I hope they love this podcast. I have loved this conversation with you. If they've got networking questions, find me, on Twitter. And I know that's the easiest place to find me, and or over on my website. And I know you're going to have all the links to those things in the liner notes. And so find that stuff there. Read Build Your Dream Network. I mean, I dish out networking advice, and it's networking advice I follow. I eat my own dog food. So, read the book, come and ask me your questions, and, I'm happy to provide answers.
Awesome. And your story is testament to that it works. So thank you, Kelly. You're an amazing guest. And folks, don't forget, happy career, happy life.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget, happy career, happy life.